Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
I'm originally from Malaysia. So at the age of seven, I did ask my parents whether they could send me to Singapore to study. And at the age of eight, I left. I'm the only child, by the way. So I left the family. They stayed there in Malaysia and I came on my own to Singapore to begin my education. And I was living with different families, sort of moving from family to family because I was too young to live in a hostel. So that was that. And I went to the UK for my university studies. And my career started with Singapore Airlines. So when I was at Singapore Airlines and I thought, and I've always had a desire to work and live overseas. And they then had this, they still do have this station manager scheme. These are basically airport managers that they post from Singapore to various countries, right? You don't have a say where you go and when you go. They just say, okay, there it is, you're gonna go there. So they always had that scheme, but they never took in girls. So I opportunity came about and we were asking and I was saying, why don't you consider us girls? Bonders if you need to, because they were concerned that girls were going to get married and kids and then, leave the workforce, right? So that was a concern at that point of time. So the opportunity was given and I was the first female station manager for Singapore Airlines. The first place I was posted to was Frankfurt as an assistant station manager. So they send you there, a very busy place, lots of VIPs, head of states, like your Henry Kissinger's coming through. So you have wonderful one-on-one, 1.5 hours time at Frankfurt Airport with Henry Kissinger. There's a kind of opportunity we had. I was in Frankfurt for 10 months. Then they posted me to what they call a smaller station. Less busy place. I was in Copenhagen. And right after 9/11, I was posted to JFK, New York. Wow. And then right after SARS, I was posted to Hong Kong. You can see the pattern there, right? After each disaster, I guess, go to a place. So it was fantastic. I enjoyed that very much. And I think the scheme pretty much worked out because, till now, there are still girls, in that job. And whilst I was with Singapore Airlines, an opportunity came about by Far East Organization, a very large private real estate developer based out of Singapore, a family business. And that's where, if you've read the case study by Linda Hill, it's EasLink at Far East Organization that sort of depicted my experience over there. So I joined Far East in hospitality and then I'm moving on to retail. And I spent about 8 years there. And whilst there, I had an opportunity with my current employer, the Beijing Hualien Group, that's based out of China, they're Chinese, to actually move to Beijing. So I lived in Beijing in 2013 to 2015. Fantastic experience. I took on the opportunity because I wanted to try China. I had worked in the Southeast Asia, States, Europe, but China was something new. And I said, let me just, get my hands on it. So I was there for 2 years, beautiful. And the group decided to list a REIT, a real estate investment trust, on the Singapore Stock Exchange. That's when I moved back back in 2015. So since then, I've been the CEO of the REIT. Exciting times. We own 6 properties, all based in China at this point of time. Sort of leveraging on the whole middle income growth, domestic consumption that's happening in China. In fact, I just came back from 2 back-to-back trips to China, in Beijing and Chengdu. Fantastic. It's opened up. So that's what I'm doing at the moment. So I think pre-COVID, I used to travel quite a lot to China. And I can sense now that things have opened up. I will continue with my travels there and we'll obviously look at acquisitions and suitable real estate to inject into the REIT. So that's what I'm doing at this point of time.
Well, super exciting, very, very diverse background. It probably made more sense to cover the places where you haven't been or where you haven't worked versus it seems like you've spent time at least a couple of years in all of the major hubs. And that probably shaped a very, very broad perspective on what you're currently building. But to backtrack a little bit, I want to give a little bit of a background on the case method and just overall what happens at the Harvard, because not every school is the same way. So at Harvard Business School, the teaching method is through case method, where the case is presented to the class and we study the case and we essentially try to put ourselves in the shoes of the main character, the protagonist in each case. And we discuss that and we come up with strategies, what we would do essentially in their shoes. And one of those cases was on you, Islin. And but I want to backtrack a little bit. The story behind actually getting Harvard Business School interested in writing a case study about you and the work that you've done and what you're currently building. Tell us a little bit, you know, behind, you know, the story behind that. How does that happen? Essentially, maybe share as much as you can about the overall process. How does that all come together?
Yeah, it was exciting. I was serendipity, I think. I mean, you know, I attended GMP 12 back in 2012, you know, when I was still with Far East. Mm-hmm. So I think it was great. I mean, you know, back then I was on the other side, right? So, you know, doing case studies and various things. And I think the opportunities just sort of came about, you know, with Professor Linda Hill. And she said, hey, you know, you're with Singapore Airlines, exciting, you know, first female station manager. And now you are in, you know, hospitality and in retail, right? Interesting, because you're a lift out. I'm like, oh, what's a lift out? You know, I'm sure you recall that mentioned, you know, when she was teaching the case. So I think Harvard wanted to come up with a case, I would say probably, you know, set in this part of the world, in Asia, you know, and hospitality was obviously something, sort of industry that most people would be able to relate to, right? Because we all stay in hotels and we travel for work or leisure. And it was exciting because they found it relevant. They found that there was a need for a case like that because it was a mid-career move, right? I sort of, you know, moved to FI's organization after spending a substantial number of years with Singapore Airlines, you know, and then suddenly I'm moving into a new culture. And not only have I moved into a new culture, I need to make changes, right? Like, you know, service culture change, et cetera, within that new organization. So I think Harvard felt that, hey, that would be a very interesting case where a lot of people at different points of their careers would be doing that. I think another quite interesting part, which again will resonate with a lot of people, was that I was from the airline industry, right? And now I am going into hospitality. So where is the similarity, right? So I thought it was interesting because a lot of people were thinking, I'm not going to switch or move. You know, I'm going to make a move into some of the industries where I have no, you know, exposure in. Is that going to work or not, right? So it was that. And I was also part of the list outs where a number of us from Singapore Airlines did move into Far East, right? So that made it a little bit more interesting. It wasn't like we were setting up a clique or anything like that, but there were a number of us enough that perhaps could move the needle a bit in terms of, you know, customer service culture that we want, you know, to attain, right? So I think that was interesting. So I think with all that sort of set in place, I recalled that, you know, Linda Hill and a few other, you know, research assistants all flew into Singapore. And by then I had sort of shortlisted key people for her to interview, right, which included my superiors, my peers, my direct reports, you know, ladies from the housekeeping department. I said, these are very important. This is the heart. You remember that?
Yeah.
We use translators because a number of them didn't speak English. The doorman, I mean, you know, Hamdan was very excited about it. Hamdan spoke English, was very excited that, you know, he was, you know, such an important person in our service departments, right? And he was there, he gave his feedback, and, you know, it was fantastic. So that's what we did. I spent a number of days in Singapore, and, you know, they were very accurate, you know, they were very, very detailed. They wanted to make sure that everything was reflected accurately, you know, so back and forth with info, you know, and visiting the various properties as well. You know, after having gone back, it continued, the whole story writing continued, right? It has to be signed off by the CEO of Far East organization. So, yeah. I mean, Harvard really has all this protocol in place, right? You know, so there was that. And one thing you may not be aware of, it sort of appeared in HBX, which is the online version, right, of the Harvard Business School case study, was that subsequently another team of people came as well. After I had joined BHGB as CEO and to do an online version of things. So that was quite fun.
Oh, wow.
It was more leadership style as a VC CEO.
Right. Oh, that's super exciting. That's very interesting. So how did that feel when you actually got the final case in your hands and actually read the whole, because you've already gone through the whole exercise, studying the cases and participating in the whole exercise during your time at GMP. So how did that feel actually just reading the case on yourself and all of that? Just tell us a little bit about that.
I mean, almost unbelievable. I was like, oh my gosh, it's like, it's a case about me. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, in the past, we're always, you know, reading, you know, doing cases about other people, right? And yeah. when you do the case, I'm sure you understand, Jean, you're so deep into it. It's like, you're so immersed into that person's life, right? So I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened. And Harvard made it, you know, an effort to actually mail the actual case study to me. You know, to my, I think for them, a residential address. Yeah, they asked for the address and they sent me quite a few of that and said, you know, you're going to have that, right? Even though we have the online version. So it was beautiful. I mean, it was nice and it was, but what I felt was, I hoped that it had really helped a lot of people that had gone through different stages of their career. You know, obviously, you know, Harvard comes with a whole variety of different scenarios. They try to cover as many as they can. They try to be as relevant as they can. And hopefully, and then sometimes I do get people reaching out to me and say, you know what, I was going through a very difficult time, you know, in my career switch. And glad to know that, you know, you kind of went through a tough time as well. You sort of came out of it, you know, and yeah, it was enlightening. So I think I really hope that it had helped people, as, you know, some of the case studies have helped me as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can attest myself that it definitely helped me personally, because during my time at GMP, I was in the transitional period myself. I was coming from like corporate, very structured, in technology space, and I had different avenues, different opportunities to go in different directions, whether in entrepreneurial, very small company, or join kind of on the investing side into the VC space. So just putting myself in the shoes of kind of what you had gone through, that exercise, weighing all the pros and cons, and just essentially it was definitely an eye-opener, and it definitely helped a lot through that thought process in general. So that's, you know, thank you for that, all the things that shared in that case method. And we'll make kind of link to that case study in our show notes for our listeners as well, so that they're able to see what we're talking about. So fast forward a little bit, you're now with BHG, and from just overall real estate perspective, maybe share some of the trends that you are currently excited about, maybe that are specific to your area or just on a global scale. I would like to start the conversation from that standpoint, mainly because my lens, a point of view, only on the Southeast US market, where we invest very heavily in different types of real estate. But we just came back from the tour of Southeast Asia, Singapore, Jakarta, and KL. Looked at a lot of different opportunities, and it's a completely different spectrum. So curious to get your take on that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, a very good, very timely question, honestly, right? So I think one of the key things I'm pretty excited about at the moment is how countries are evolving post-COVID. You know, I mean, whatever you say, I know COVID's over, but still it's got a very big impact on people's lives, right? I mean, 3 years of that is a long time. So, you know, I when things started opening up in Singapore last year, I think end of last year, one of the first places I went to was actually Tokyo, because I was telling my husband, I said, well, I need to go somewhere. I have to get out, you know? And I went to Tokyo because I wanted to just get a sense, because I love cities. I love urban living. I wanted to see how things were, you know, post-COVID for Japan. It was good. It was exciting. And another thing which, you know, I'm very excited about is the whole reopening of China, because it's got a direct impact on our business, because all our malls are situated there. So you can imagine last year was the hardest year we had, 2022, because of the sporadic lockdowns, you know, in different parts of the cities, right? So we have malls in different cities. But I'm happy to say that, you know, I mean, this time after going back, you know, have noticed some changes. I mean, first of all, it does feel like COVID never happened. Like in Beijing, out of 10 people, maybe a few were wearing masks, right, voluntarily. So that was the only difference, right? In the past, nobody wore masks. So in Chengdu, out of 10, almost like 0.5 will wear a mask. So most were maskless, right? So apart that some mask wearing here and there, it feels as if COVID never happened in China. Everything was exactly the same as it was, you know, the airport, the places I used to go to, everything was fantastic. But what's interesting about the lifestyles post-COVID is that we see people are eating out even more than they did. I think because when you have lockdowns, right, you appreciate the simple gesture of just gathering with friends to eat out together, right? It was good. We noticed that some of the wellness was picking up, right? You know, wellness was always a big thing anyway, you know, but more gyms, more smaller format gyms with longer operating hours have sprung up now. More yoga studios, right? Wellness has come in. Obviously, you know, cinemas are back in action now. You have all the top blockbuster movies coming in as well, because that was, again, restricted during the past 3 years, right? And people, and a lot of casual wear, sportswear, I'm not sure about it, the States. I think this part of the world, right, post-COVID, everyone is now just dressing down a lot more.
Yes.
So even my team is now, oh, I was like, okay, denim on a Tuesday, all right, okay. So everyone's dressing down now, wearing
sneakers. Here as well.
Here too, right, you see?
Yeah.
China too, same thing, you know. I see less heels, I see more sneakers. So that's great. So I see that, right? And I think people are beginning to travel a bit more now. I could see that they're getting out more. So I think things are going to, return back to normal, but with a bit more vengeance than before. So I think the post-COVID world in different urban societies is something I'm very excited about. And I want to see how things continue to evolve. The omni-channel retailing, I think that's going to be big, because during COVID, some of the retailers who didn't have online presence were forced to have it, right?
Yeah.
So I think everyone is aware now that, look, I'm going to have a physical shop because people are going to come to the physical shop, but I must have an online presence in case another pandemic strikes, God forbid. Okay. Then at least I can reach out to people on both ends. So I think that accelerated omni-channel retailing in China as well. So that's exciting. Another thing I'm pretty excited about is AI. I mean, you know, you can't have a podcast without having ChatGPT mentioned, right? So what I did was, when I was in Beijing, I wanted ChatGPT to write a poem for me about me having returned to Beijing after 3 years and meeting up with friends and how it's great. So I got it to write for me in English, which was pretty well written. And I tested its Mandarin as well. It was very well written.
Wow.
Beautiful. And I posted it on my WeChat and people were like, "You kidding me?" I said, "No, I'm not kidding you." So that's great. So AI is one big thing. That obviously in the retail business, you know, is going to be something which will be very much intermingled in our lives and all that, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the next thing, you know, ESG, right? We can't run away from that, like it or not, right? ESG, you know, whether in our personal lives or in our businesses, is big, right? Environmental, saving electricity and water. It sounds very basic for a mall operator, but these are the key things, right? Carbon emission. And one key difference I noticed this time in China versus 3 years ago is like electrical vehicles everywhere. I mean, literally, you enter Beijing Capital Airport and there are really some EV cars on display there. And then you get into a cab, it's an EV, right? And then buses are operated by EVs. And you go to any malls, right? You have car showrooms, EV car showrooms in all the malls. So it's really in your face. I think that's one area where I think China is making big progress, right, in terms of, you know, environmental and all that.
Yeah.
The other part, I think, is one area we should never forget.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot, sometimes it doesn't get reported enough, but during the pandemic, right, or even with or without the pandemic, mental wellness is a very big thing. So I think, you know, socially, you know, whether, you know, it's about reaching out and helping out to the less, you know, fortunate, whether by the malls themselves, creating a space within our malls to do that, or whether it means in my own office, right? I mean, I run a small team, less than 10 people, but to create a very safe environment where they feel safe to come to work. Because things are different, right? After the pandemic, I mean, things have changed. Priorities have changed for people now, where they can, you know, come to work and feel safe to report to work. I mean, that's this one key thing as well.
Right.
So just put a few things I've been, yeah.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I can definitely relate to some of the things you're talking about, and, you know, from a lens of the US market as well, which seems like very global perspective on all the different trends and insights that we see in just overall real estate space. Can you share some of your personal thoughts on just the residential market, maybe that's specific to your area? Because we've been seeing some very different cycles that at least we have gone through in the US residential market, with the interest in the rates and all of the things that are being done to combat the inflation and all of the other economic trends. Maybe share some thoughts from residential standpoint. What are you currently seeing? Maybe some of the things that you stayed away from, and where do you see the market, at least in your area, going in the next 18 to 24 months?
I would say that's a very good question. I mean, for Singapore, residential has been moving up, right? Despite the interest rate. I mean, you would have read that Singapore has become a very popular place for people from various parts of the world moving here and sort of migrating to Singapore. People from China, Hong Kong, Thailand, and I was told even from from Europe and some from States as well. So a lot of people have been moving in particularly over the last 2 to 3 years, right? So, and the government has already, you know, in the last decade, right, have been coming up with various cooling measures and all kinds of additional, you know, stamp duty imposed, etc., to try to manage the prices, because, you know, because people are still buying no matter what. So I think, and that, I don't see the trend stopping, honestly. People are still definitely, you know, as far as, let's say, foreigners, for example, despite the cooling measures, they're still coming in to buy properties. That's one, or because they want to move to Singapore, that's one. And then for the Singaporeans, what we call the upgraders, so about 85% of Singaporeans actually live in what they call HDB flats, right? Housing Development Board flats, which are basically government sort of subsidized flats, right? So they start off with that, and once they have the opportunity to sell that off, they always make a profit. And when they make that profit, they will then take that profit and they will what they call upgrade. So they're known as upgraders to a condominium to a private apartment. So yeah. These people, so despite the despite the interest rate having gone up, right, we still see reports of launches. There was one, I just read, there was one launch that was done. 50% was of the units were sold within a day. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of Singapore, the residential market is going to continue to stay very hot because the destination itself is a very coveted place, right? So and people and Singaporeans typically do save, and couples do work, so they also can use partial of what they call the CPF, the savings fund, to pay towards a housing mortgage as well. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, a lot of measures are not going to just get these people down and say, I'm not going to buy things anymore. Rental market has gone up the roof. It's crazy. I've got Malaysian friends who are renting a room here. They used to pay SGD 600 for a room a month in an HDB, and upon renewal, it's $1,100. That's wow. Real. Big news. It's real. So some of them say, oh, I'm going to move back to JB. I'm going to live in, you know, Johor Bahru in Malaysia. I'm going to commute every day, you know? So it's a very hot thing, and residential is big. So our REITs, we don't buy into residential. We are more into retail malls at this point of time, particularly focused on China, because that's where we see the growth, right? So the whole domestic consumption, rural urban migration, middle class growth. So that is where we see the growth, you know, in terms of a shopping mall like that, that we're investing at the moment.
Very interesting. And so a further question to double click on the retail and the shopping center as an asset class. At least from my very limited view here in the US, it seems like a downward trend when we talk about malls, when we talk about physical shopping centers. Used to be a very hot, you know, asset class, you know, maybe 10 years ago. But it seems like, at least from a perspective of a regular shopper, when you go to the mall, it's a ghost town. Are you seeing anything from that perspective, that type of shift with the online shopping and all of the things that we're seeing with the Amazons of the world, stuff like that? How are you thinking about those types of trends, and what are you doing to prepare for something like that?
Very good question. I think every time when it comes to China malls, right, that's the first question people ask, because the whole e-commerce penetration has always been big since decades ago. The Taobao's has been huge, right? Delivery is so fast, you know, and people always ask, so what does that happen? So basically what's happened in China is this: when the whole e-commerce penetration took place, it happened pretty quickly. And what happened was that the category of retail that suffered the most was the traditional department stores. So because all the products are sold online, so a lot of them closed down almost immediately. And the other category of physical shops that were affected as well were your electronics shop, right? Because the Jingdong JD.com, I mean, if you order something by 11 a.m. this morning, you will get it by today. If you order today, you get it tomorrow, right? So it was fantastic. So those two categories actually suffered. But what we realized was the two extreme ends were doing very well. So that's where my group is very much involved in the very high-end luxury malls, right, that sells luxury items, that shot up the roof. Right? It went up the roof because the middle income people were growing more and more. They were, you know, income was growing, you know, disposable income was growing. The ability to spend grew as well. People want to spend on themselves. So that part is fantastic. I just went to our group's high-end luxury mall that opened in Chengdu in December last year. It's crazy, amazing. So that's one. So the other category of retail that is doing very well in China is the suburban malls. We call it community malls or suburban malls, typically located in very high densely populated area, maybe 200 to 500,000 people within a two, three kilometers radius. So it's a neighborhood mall. People need to go there. So what's happened in Asia today, like in China or even Singapore, the mall now has become a third space for people to hang out. In fact, they have a very strong emotional reliance on this mall because it's a third space for you to hang out apart from your home, your school, and your workplace, right? So what attracts you to this mall? You go in, the supermarket is there. It's always anchored by a supermarket in the basement. You have the cinema on level 5. And then this part of the world, we don't cook. You know, a lot of people don't know how to cook, right? The millennials say, you know what? I don't know how to cook. So F&B is big, right? There's all kinds of F&B there, from your McDonald's, Pizza Hut, KFC, to your Haidilao hot pot, to anything you want, whether you're dining alone, 5 of you, whole family is there for you. So people go there to eat. And then after they eat, they say, you know what? I want to buy something from Uniqlo or H&M or something, or Nike, right? I just want to just walk around, right? So I can buy online, but I want to buy it now, right now. I want to walk around and try on something and pick it up and bring it home right now. So yeah, they do that. And there's a lot of children's education and entertainment. So kids go for their, you know, violin classes, street dance classes. Then adults go for their yoga class and, you know, gym. The dentist is there as well. So wow, it becomes really a one-stop place. And I was in Beijing and there was an alpaca in a shop. It was in a basement shop. It was a petting zoo. I was like, what's going on? It was a mountain goat. I mean, it was like cute, right? It's a pet. So that's happened now in this part of the world, and particularly in China. And what's happened is that in China, when you have the government encouraging your rural urban migration, people are moving from the rural area to the urban cities. And when they do, they're not going to live in the city center, right smack. No, they're not going to be in District 1 or Zone 1 or 2. They'll be in Zone 6, Zone 5. A bit way up. If not, there'll be too much congestion, right? That's when the government encourages schools, malls, clinics to be located to serve the people around there. So we see that this kind of category of malls is going to grow. But I think, you know what, but Jan, the challenge now is what? The challenge I have today is, how do you keep up with the changing, you know, taste and the aspirations of the middle-class Chinese? That is the part we need to really get our hands on. After a while, they're going to be like, you know what? This is so passe now. No more cheesecake. No, we want something new. It's bubble tea. Tomorrow, another bubble tea, you know? So they want very exciting things, right? So it's how do we keep our tenants fresh to get these people coming back again and again and again? Mm-hmm. So that's that.
I actually just recently read boba tea is one of the fastest growing segments in its particular vertical. I'm not sure if it's classified fast food or whatever the category is. But in US, it's one of the fastest growing categories. So I can also see a lot of the influence from kind of your part of the market coming to the US. So that's very interesting. And I can definitely relate to having visited malls in, you know, Singapore, Indonesia, and Malaysia. It's completely different. It's an actual lifestyle place where, like you've mentioned, you get not only the retail and the shopping places and food, but also, you know, anything from dentists, from essentially anything that you need for the everyday life. So that makes a lot of sense, kind of from just betting on that, being very bullish from that standpoint. So that, thank you for clarifying that. The kind of the other side of the spectrum, and that was very well highlighted in your case, in the Harvard's case about you, is ability to recruit and hire exceptional people. At the end of the day, for us as executives, that's at the top of our minds, to surround ourselves with the best talent, whether we actively recruiting or not. And I wanted to get your view into how do you approach hiring. It's a very complicated space, and it's something that, you know, it's challenging, but the more you do that, at least if you have a structure and a process in place to be able to do that, I notice those are some of the components that people that are much more successful in that space versus the others. Share your thoughts on hiring, share your thoughts on, you know, just overall attracting the top talent.
Well, good question. So in this space, obviously, you know, it's quite a competitive space, right? I mean, we have like 40 over weeks in Singapore.
Yeah.
You know, so, and, you know, and we are licensed, you know, so it will be a bit like a musical chair, as they call it. Some people move from this read to that read. So it's not the easiest thing, to be very honest. Especially when we first started out, right? They were like, oh, who are you guys again? I mean, we were very big in China, but when we come to Singapore, they may not be so aware of who we are, right? So we're like competing with the local developers, you know, with the Greeks and stuff like that. So I think some of the key channels we like to use is, I think headhunters is one. We don't like paying the fees, but you have to pay the fees because at least these people, they know where to look out for the key people that are relevant, right? Because I think when we are running a REIT, it's so highly regulated by the Singapore Stock Exchange, it's by the Monetary Authority of Singapore, and so many sort of so highly regulated in general, right? That ideally you want to get someone who can come in and hit the ground running if you can. I mean, that would be the most ideal, someone who has done similar things before. But I've also hired people who have not done similar things before, but they've picked up. So I'm open to both. So headhunters is one. So I've used them and they're very effective because you tell them exactly what you need. The other one that we use will be basically referral, right? You know, through people we know, because that is actually one of the most beautiful things, because it's, imagine a current employee helping you get another employee, and then you can imagine the whole of, you know, and how credible that is, right? They're going to say, you know what, you're with this company, you know, I'm willing to, you know, and you're vouching for it. So these are the two key ones, really. Of course, sometimes there are people writing in as well. I always like to test people out, right? I always tell the headhunter, just, okay, you know, I'll just message the person beforehand. They wouldn't know who I am. They'll just say that, okay, I'm going to meet you, at this cafe or whatever, and, you know, at this time. And I like to test the response time sometimes, you know, because it's good to be, you know, we like responsive people, you know, and see how they actually sort of, you know, get back. So it's quite nice little test to do. But these are the few channels that we use. And I think one of the key things we have quite prided ourselves in all these years is that we're known to have a very good work environment. And we're not the biggest REIT out there, but for those who care about a hygienic work environment, this is the place. So they will ask around, they will even ask the professionals that serve us. So, you know, everything's transparent. They will ask our auditors, they will ask our internal auditors, external auditors, they will ask the compliance people and say, hey, you know, what is it like dealing with them, right? And they give that feedback. It's not easy to always retain talent. I mean, we have a number of staff who have stayed throughout, which is great, but some do get poached from time to time. So this is just, but you know what? When you get poached, sometimes you wish them all the best, but you stay in touch. So it feels like you've got additional staff out there, actually. Sometimes they stay in touch and they send me updates on, you know, on the industry and all that. It's like, oh, my team has expanded now, you know? And we go for dinner and karaoke sessions, right? Inviting ex-staff. So it's quite nice. So we do that. Yeah, so it's not easy. It's not easy to fight for talent, particularly in certain fields, right? Like compliance is one of the toughest ones because they're so sought after. And all the high networks coming to Singapore are now setting up their own family offices, you know, and everyone needs a compliance guy. You can imagine, right? And then our team speaks Chinese as well. So we've got bilingual people. So you can imagine just how popular they could be, right? So it's not easy. It's not the easiest thing, but it's a balance that we actually work on.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And the channels you've mentioned are definitely helpful. One of the things that I wanted to take a little bit further is get a glimpse into an interview with you. You've mentioned that you like to also structure conversations maybe a little bit outside of the norm of the, you know, the office or the conference room, and just take it somewhere, you know, and get to know the candidate on a personal level, which I love. I love that example because I subscribe to that process as well, where, you know, at the end of the day, it's an opportunity for a candidate as well to interview you and, you know, ask their questions in order for them to figure out, is this the type of leader I can succeed under, or is this the type of environment that I can thrive in? And so creating that interview as a two-way channel, communication is, I can definitely see that works. But tell us a little bit further about how do you, you know, vet the candidates, maybe the types of questions that you like to ask that help you uncover certain personality traits and basically make a determination through a very short conversation at the end of the day if this is the right fit for the type of culture you're looking to cultivate at your company.
Yeah, so one of the things I like to ask is, how would your bosses describe you? You know, how would your peers describe you? How would your staff describe you? And what would, you know, and of course, what would be your, you feel your top two strengths or your areas you want to work on, right? This is always the crux of it, you know, and they're relaxed when they talk about it, and they're always truthful about it. I mean, there's nothing to make up about it, right? So yeah. I think based on that, we can get a certain sense. And then sometimes I like to ask questions like, you know, between speed and being meticulous, you know, where are you on that line, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because sometimes, you know, most people can't be everything, right? You can't be super fast and super accurate, right? So sometimes, you know, so where are you? Just get a sense of where they could be, so I could look out, right? I'm just going to determine whether we hire them or not, but at least it will help me determine that when they first come in, they will do their best to rush things out for you, but maybe they may not be as meticulous. Or the other way around, he's very meticulous, but he needs more time. So stuff like that, yeah. So I always like to just write down, I always put that, yeah, staff, you know, sort of write down, okay, what does staff say? Okay, you know, yeah. Or how would they, you know, and what would be the top two strengths, you know, they will say about you and two areas that they wish you could do better in, you know? Right. So, yeah. So that always helps, right? But mm-hmm. the rest of it will be obviously what they do during their free time and, you know, what matters to them and all that. That's good as well. But this is, this is one of the key set of questions I always ask.
I like that. I like that a lot, especially the first question that you ask. I ask a variation of that in a sense, if I was to talk to your manager, what would they say that you need to improve on? And usually it's kind of also a test whether they're actually listening to what you're asking about. And that's very interesting. And I like what you do with the interviews because you also allowing for them to essentially open up and just be able to be themselves, at least through that very, a lot of times, uncomfortable conversation at that one time instance. So that makes a lot of sense.
I always try to do it in a cafe. I think it's so much nicer. Have a coffee, chit chat, you know, it's really nice. Yeah. But I mean, it was interesting because COVID time when we did that, I became almost like an unagony, you know? So people were just sharing things. It was nice, but it was like, it was running the 1.5 hour interview because they wanted to talk. So that's nice.
I like that. That's a great tip because a lot of times you're so in the zone and everything is done in a very formal office environment. And I think I can definitely see a lot of benefits to that because you can see probably the other side of the candidate when you take kind of that casual approach. So definitely thank you for sharing that. The last portion of every podcast, I like to focus on you just individually from a perspective of your content diet and the information and the resources you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself educated, informed of all the things going on in your industry, or maybe even for personal development. Share your strategy, share your process, share some of the resources that you like to use.
I think first of all, you know, there's so many things I'm interested in, and I'm more a hands-on sort of person. So I think the first option, the first mode of absorption is always to visit a place to experience things for myself. So it just means I'm out there. You know, I can read a book, but I prefer to be out there, right? So if the moment China opened up, I went there, Tokyo or wherever I was traveling to. So I like to be out there to experience things for myself and to speak to people on the ground. That's always my preferred, right? And if I don't get a chance to do that, then I want to buy someone coffee, buy someone who's very an expert in the particular industry to have coffee and have a chat with that person, right? So that because that becomes really firsthand, more than what a book could give to you. And you know, I like to go on to really nonstop, like, social media, you know, to get my news feed, right? So whether it's Facebook, you know, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, you know, very controversial topic, you know, and if I want to research on Chinese related things, I go to Baidu. Right, and all kinds of apps out there to gain information on what I want to go into. And I go really deep sometimes. I when I research really deep, I can go up to 2-3 a.m. in the morning because I'm just really into it, right? So I mean, you know, the wide range of things that really interest me. I mean, you know, of course AI is one, but you know, current affairs, history is something triggers me, and I'm like, just I go deep into the history thing. Or a particular character, right? Like, wellness, lifestyle, I'm into that as well. Medical, someone mentioned a certain, you know, illness, and, you know, and I'm deep into it, right? And I'll message friends who are doctors and say, what do you think of this? So I go all kinds of channels and I go very deep, you know, and I do that on a quite a regular basis. So quite random, sometimes.
Makes sense.
Pretty random. Yeah. So, you know, this is what I do. Yeah. And I enjoy that. I love that. Yeah. I've got some books out there. Not fully read. You know, I've got some books lying out there. I've got Ikigai. I've got Forest Bathing. I've got You Can Heal Yourself by Louise Hay. I've got the book by Harry, Spare. I got Spare.
Right.
And some wealth management books, different things out there that I sort of touch at different points of time. Yeah, so that's why I do that.
Is there one book that you always recommend to others, or what's your most gifted book that you like to share with others, or do you have one?
Yeah, you know what? I don't have a most gifted book. I don't have one book that I do recommend, but I have one talk that I attended at GMP, and I'm not doing advertising for GMP, believe me. But there's one talk I attended during my GMP 12. I'm not sure you went through that, by Joe Bauer, Professor Joe Bauer. It's called Manager in the Middle. It's one thing I consistently talk about, because it's about, if you're a manager in the middle, you have bosses on top of you, you have a team of staff that you run, how much should you apportion your time with each one, right? And I always thought that, you could have spent a lot of time, you know, managing staff and all, you know, your bosses, right? But interestingly, what they're prescribing is that you should spend 50% of your time managing yourself. That's a lot, managing yourself. And the remaining 50, you divide amongst bosses, peers, right? And then, you know, and your subordinates, which surprisingly is not a lot on staff. But your staff don't need to be overmanaged, really. So that is the one thing I always keep sharing with people, because I think it is amazing. And the other thing I want to just add on, if I could, you know, you ask for one, I'm going to give you two, is asking for feedback. I think in the States, you guys probably do it quite naturally, right? But in Asia, it's not so easy, particularly when you have a boss asking staff for feedback. Like, can you give feedback about me, right? They're like, oh my gosh, you should I? So I like the way it was done in our living groups, right? So basically they paired us up and you keep switching partners, right?
Right.
It's simple. You just ask each other, what would you like me to do more of, less of, or the same? And it's not bad. And it's very structured, it's very easy. It makes the person quite comfortable about telling you what they want you to do more of, less of, or the same. So these are the two things I always keep, you know, prescribing. And I think that, I mean, it can really take you quite far if you're able to do these two things.
That's great. And that's a great reminder. I actually now remember that exercise, soliciting feedback, that we've done with our living cohorts. It was definitely very interesting and eye-opening exercise, which applies to every day, not only in professional career, but also in our personal lives as well. So that makes a lot of sense. Islan, last but not least, I have a very loaded question for you. And think of maybe an advice or series of advice that you would give to your younger self, to, let's say, early 20s yourself, when you're just starting out your career, knowing what you know now, things that you've gone through, what would be some of the things that you would share with yourself?
Well, that's a very good one. You know what? One of the things I'll say to myself is, you know what? Be yourself. Do not change who you are. And I'm glad I haven't changed all these years, really. I'm still the girly me, you know. It doesn't matter whatever I'm doing. I just, you know, I'm myself. So that's the key thing. Always have your true north. Be yourself. Do not change who you are to fit into a mold or to fit into a society or to fit into, you know, a clique or anything like that, or organizational structure. Just be yourself, right? And I think the other thing would be, if I had the hindsight, right, it would be, spend more time taking care of yourself. I think, like I said, why this Joe Bauer thing was such a big thing was because I had burnout moments. I had so many burnout moments because I was just doing so much. Right? Actually, hey, if you actually took good care of yourself, right, do the things you enjoy, you stay still, whether it's a meditation or just enjoying the things that you do, you will be able to do other things a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I wish I that when you're younger, you're just pushing yourself all the time, right? Yeah. So I think this will be the couple of key things that, you know, and also I think one of the key things would be, you know what, just enjoy life, you know. I mean, whatever ups and downs, right, you're gonna have, particularly things that you don't get, you're gonna get something a lot better. Yeah. Really. That's one thing I've always learned, right? And you know, some of us feel so disappointed when we want something so bad and we don't get it, right? And we say, hey, you know what? Because something better is gonna happen to you, just round the corner, just, you know, just be a little bit more patient, it's coming, and you're going to deserve something even better. So that's what I'm going to tell my younger self.
That's great. Very powerful, Lisling, and I definitely appreciate your time today. Very insightful, short conversation, but I personally learned quite a bit. So I definitely thank you for your time. And like with all the guests on Ivy Podcast, what I love doing is a follow-up recording in about a year and see if everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
For sure. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.